coming up on Weekend America.
The Olympics are here, and Olga Korbut knows what's at stake.
If you win audience, public, folks, whatever, this is biggest medal in your life, because if audience love you, everybody will love you.
Find out what the Soviet sweetheart is doing now. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. You can tell a lot about a person from his suitcase.
The little brown suitcase with all the travel stickers on it, and it has a lot of treasures in it and fishing items, lures and paints. Obviously, this person was a fisherman artist type.
Our summer travel series continues. And what's the perfect roller coaster?
A giant drop. Like a really
big
drop.
You need to go very fast.
85.
No, way 85. Faster. Like 200.
It feels like 88.
Weekend America's coming quick after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And in St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper. We're into the thick of summer, when the oppressive heat can only be bested by our sheer determination to have fun. So this hour, we're going to take you on the roller coaster ride of your life. We'll visit a landmark in Seattle's Japantown. And we'll go to Baltimore, where one man has gone all out for Frank Zappa Day. Here's a hint. You've heard the saying, beware of Greeks bearing gifts? Well, what about Lithuanians bearing busts? But that's later. Right now, we want to know about your favorite roller coaster ride.
My favorite roller coaster ride starts off going uphill.
Trek uphill and make clickety-clackety noise and scare me to death.
Then you go down and it's like, ah!
It had loop-de-loops and upside-downs and it shook and vibrated and it was unforgettable.
You know, you're trying to hold your hands up like everybody else, but you really better put them down and put your hand on the ball.
I always love those roller coasters because they go really, really fast down, like towards water, and I usually get really scared, but I love it at the same time.
Oh, love and fear. Get used to that combination, my friend.
I love my boyfriend holding onto a roller coaster and yelling, "Mama," the whole time. Those voices came to us from New York City, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and St. Louis.
The Olympics was such an incredible experience.
And I got this flag on my hand and I don't know what to do. So I put it up in the air and the whole place goes crazy.
No swimmer in the history of the Olympics has won 5 gold medals in a single year.
The tears just start rolling down your eyes and you start thinking about all the years and all the people who helped me to get to that point.
We compete for the honor and the glory of sport.
This weekend, American eyes are, of course, on Beijing, where the Olympic Games are underway. This year, more than 10,000 athletes are competing from 205 countries. The U.S. teams total 596 competitors. Most of those athletes have been toiling away in obscurity for years for a shot at greatness. And after the Games, most of them will go back to obscurity. Hopefully richer for the experience, but a few will stay with us forever. Personally, I could never forget the sprightly 17-year-old Olga Korbut. She actually lives in America now, but in 1972, she was the Soviet gymnast who, for a while anyway, melted Cold War tensions at the Munich Games.
My name is Olga Korbut. I own 4 gold medals and 2 silver. In 1972, my favorite memory is when I've been such recognizable, so I feel like at home and all world is mine.
A teenage girl who has suddenly come from a place called Grodno, Byelo, Russia, to perform before 11,000 people in the Olympic Games.
I loved that. This is what I loved about the Olympic Games. This was like a big family.
Now watch this. Watch this. Back somebody right to the other bar.
Has that been done before by
never,
a girl?
Never. Not by any human that I know of.
Korbut flip is like my trademark because nobody do it until now. After 35 years, everybody tried, but this is such a technique element and dangerous, by the way. I always afraid to do that. but I always did it good.
This, then, is a historic performance you're watching right now in gymnastics.
This is what I felt when I did it. I fly like no bars, no beam, just air.
Oh, my God!
Actually, when I stand in and look at the audience, I didn't see them. I didn't hear them because I was so concentrated in my routine or whatever. I just hear like they clapping, but not actually clapping. You know, just like boom, boom, boom. You know, if you win audience, public, folks, whatever, this is biggest medal in your life, because if audience love you, everybody will love you.
Olga Korbut. She teaches dance now in Scottsdale, Arizona. The segment was produced by Charlie Schroeder in conjunction with the New York Times. You can hear more Olympic icons and see what they look like today when you go to our website. We've got a direct link to the New York Times feature on these Olympic icons. We're at weekendamerica.org.
This is the radio show about what's happening in America this weekend. And for some of us, that means scrambling to enjoy those summer pleasures that we kept promising ourselves we would do before the summer is over. So for you, that could mean laying in a hammock, or it could mean frenzied hysteria at 100 miles an hour with a 400-foot drop. Roller coaster technology is taking us higher and dropping us farther and faster than ever before. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark wanted to know, how much more extreme can these rides get? A little warning, you might want to lower your radio's volume a little just for a few seconds when I say go. Go.
Oh, we are really high. Oh, God.
That's me screaming. Because if I don't, I'm sure everything below my gut will disintegrate and then melt and then combust. Which makes no sense, I know, but somehow does as I careen downward 10 stories at 55 miles an hour. I'm on Ghost Rider, the longest banked drop on a wooden coaster in the western U.S. Just the kind of superlative that has inspired roller coaster designs since the 90s.
With the world's tallest water ride, the tallest drop in the area, the biggest wooden coaster on the coast.
This is the one that shoots you to 80 miles an hour in less than 3 seconds.
And everyone I talk to at Knott's Berry Farm in Southern California seems to be into these claims to fame. They're happy to ride them into the future.
So if you guys could design the coolest roller coaster ride ever, what would it have to have in it?
A giant drop, like a really
big drop.
It would
need to go very fast.
Like 200.
It feels like 88.
Like, it would have raindrops dropping from the ceiling.
At least everyone but that last girl with the raindrops. But in fact, she's kind of on to something there in terms of the future of thrill. To understand what I mean, you have to understand that amusement park rides are in the midst of a classic conflict that dates back to ancient Greece, the mind-body dichotomy. According to a veteran theme park designer named Bob Rogers, for the last 15 years, the body has won out.
We've been engaged in a roller coaster arms race. Who can make one that goes taller? Who can make one that drops faster? Who can make one that shakes us up even more?
Bob's company, BRC Imagination Arts, has designed lots of hardcore physical rides, and there's plenty more left to make. We haven't reached the limits of what our body can endure. But one day, a few years ago, he climbed into a roller coaster.
And every time I came into the station, they would say, again? I'd say, again. And then, psh, I'm off and going back onto it again.
He went 14 times in a row. He's in the industry, so they let him do that sort of thing.
And that was a lot of fun, but it was 2 weeks before I could walk in a straight line.
It wasn't just the 14 times that screwed Bob up. It was also the fact that Bob is getting old. He talked to a doctor, did research, and it turns out by your late 30s...
our brains actually shrink. Now, my teenage kids have always suspected this was true of their parents.
Bob was quick to say the brain shrinking doesn't mean he's less smart, but he is less tolerant of shaking. And then the inner ear starts to fail.
Of course, as the balance goes out of whack, your ability to tolerate a lot of sudden movement also is reduced.
And of course, this is happening to everyone over 35. So if Bob didn't want to lose customers, he was going to have to leave the body behind and come up with a plan for the mind. A plan he called...
What are we calling it? I'm sorry, I've just drawn a blank.
Illusion. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Sensory illusion. It sidesteps the limitations of the body to let the mind enjoy the thrill. It means using all the senses, smell, vibrations, sounds, simulated raindrops, to make you think you've just been on the ride of your life.
The result is that you experience all of the great chemical rush, all of the great chemical thrills of a great roller coaster, but you don't experience the physical abuse that some roller coasters give you. That's the future.
Here
so
I go.
Right here.
You all really sure you want to do this? Because everything's looking good for your launch.
To give me a taste of sensory illusion, Rob Wyatt, one of the project developers at BRC, takes me upstairs. I strap into a mock-up of their latest ride, Space Launch Experience. It's a sensory illusion of what it actually feels like to be launched into space.
Then the shuttle will swing, then the SRB is going.
So at this point, you're actually literally being put on your back.
Whoa, getting rumbled.
The subwoofer speakers pound my chest, and things called butt kickers vibrate against my back. The screen in front of me makes it look like I'm floating. They even have the sound of keys falling from someone's pockets to convince me that we're really upside down. It wasn't bad. Rob Wyatt and I are standing in front of the accelerator. Accelerator with an X.
When you hear the screams, you get these little butterflies in your stomach and you kind of go, do I really want to do this?
This is the one that goes 0 to 80 miles an hour in 3 seconds and then down a 205-foot vertical drop, a monument to the roller coaster arms race. The ride is thrilling. The pressure of the acceleration flattens our faces and the airtime at the top makes me high. When we finish the ride, I ask Rob how his sensory illusion holds up to the 2 Gs we've just actually experienced.
Do I have to answer that question?
Maybe in the future, rides will be kinder to our aging bodies. But maybe that's not the point.
Do you think that your parents like roller coaster rides?
No!
Mom went on Silver Bullet and almost puked after.
Do you think you guys are going to like roller coasters when you get older?
No! Because, like, all the other adults would get, most of the adults would get, scared and they'd feel like they would puke. So I think I would, too.
At Knott's Berry Farm in Buena Park, California, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Our summer travel series continues with a visit to a Japantown hotel that's a U.S. historic landmark. It's next on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and we're bringing you another story in our summer travel series. We are about to visit the Panama Hotel in Seattle's Japantown. For most people on vacation, the hotel is where you come back at the end of the day after you've seen the sights. The Panama is also a national historic landmark. Over the last 100 years, the Panama has been home primarily to migrant workers and Japanese families who came to the U.S. at the turn of the century. It's a place where the locals sit and talk over tea and Japanese confections. And there's more to the story of the Panama than its ability to stay in business for almost a century. It's become a sort of travel log for Japantown itself as it's changed over the years. Reporter David Weinberg heads to Seattle's Japantown, or Nihonmachi, as it's called by the locals, to bring us this story.
A couple of years ago, I saw the neon sign above the entrance to the Panama Hotel, wandered in, and ended up living there for 4 months. The Panama Hotel is like that. You never know what might happen when you go there. Even the current owner, Jan Johnson, didn't expect to end up there. She was an artist living next door to the Panama. When one day, the former owner, Takashi Hori, told her he was selling it. On a whim, she offered to buy it from him.
Because I just wanted to save it, you know, for history and to keep it alive and pass it on to the future. It's important. And he said, oh, I already have 7 bona fide offers, Jan. And I said, I don't care. And he started to laugh, and I didn't know why, really, at the time. So he said, make me an offer. So I just offered him what he wanted, and then there was like 10 months of tea and talk, and here we are.
The Panama Hotel is a 6-story brick building overlooking Puget Sound, constructed in 1910 by Seattle's first Japanese-American architect. It was designed as a working man's hotel for the Japanese immigrants who'd come to work in the Pacific Northwest as loggers, farmers, and fishermen. But behind the wooden doors, Jan has turned the hotel into a living museum, where travelers can mingle with each other and pieces of the past. On the first floor, there's a working tea house decorated with the history of Japantown. Old black and white photographs line the brick walls. When I visit, Jan is piecing together a map of the original Japantown, and she's invited a group of men from the old neighborhood to help fill in some of the gaps. Jan unrolls her map as the old men gather around the table and point to familiar places.
Well, this is Main Street. This is Main. It was the center of the so-called ghetto. We all had ghetto living or ghetto past. You remember, yeah. 142 hotels that were held by the Japanese people.
One of the members of the group, Eddie Sano, used to work below the Panama in the Japanese bathhouse his parents owned. I ask Eddie if he'll take me down there and show me what's left of it. A couple of ladies sitting at the table next to us overhear my request and ask if they can come along too. These are the kinds of impromptu encounters that happen often at the hotel. It's exactly what Jan was hoping for.
The stairs are very rickety, and so it goes down sideways. You can see, don't step on the edges of anything.
The walls are covered with old advertisements written in Japanese. Eddie leads us past a row of small wooden lockers, one of which still has a hat and tie hanging inside.
Did you rinse off over here? And then go into the bath?
Well, we had little pans like this, and you'd scoop the water and bring it out here, and you sit and wash up as much as possible. And then you could jump in.
Okay. To get
the water cleaner.
The basement of the Panama is a massive labyrinth of passageways, one of which leads to a much darker part of the hotel's past. Jan takes me down a hallway to the locked door where she made a discovery.
I had purchased the building, but I didn't get a key to this until after 6 months, after they were through doing it.
Jan pulls a string dangling from an exposed light bulb, and the cavernous room fills with light. At first glance, the room looks like any old storage unit. There are old trunks, household items, and furniture piled up haphazardly.
This piece I love. The little brown suitcase with all the travel stickers on it. And it has a lot of old cigar boxes with treasures in it and fishing items, lures, and paints, little paint tools and things. Obviously, this person was a fisherman, artist type.
But there's a story behind this abandoned stuff, a story that dates back to 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air. President Roosevelt has just announced.
Within days of the attack, residents of Japantown were told they would be sent to internment camps, and they could take only one suitcase. It was around this time that a man came to Takashi Hori, the owner of the Panama, with a favor to ask.
One fellow down the street came over and said, "You've got a basement. Could I store my stuff here?" I says, "All right, go ahead." He put it in. He told his friend about it. And from word of mouth, you know, just spread to different people. All wanted to store their baggage here. Nobody knew how long we'd be gone, but they all expected to come back and claim their baggage. But some did and some didn't.
Mr. Hori and his family placed their own belongings in the basement and leased the building to a property management company. For the next 3.5 years, they would live in the desert of Idaho at an internment camp. After the war, Japantown would never be the same. Only half of the Japanese residents returned to Seattle. Today, most of the old hotels have been gutted and converted into low-income housing, and many of the old shops have been razed to make way for high-rise condos and parking lots. The Panama stands pretty much the same as it was before the war. Mr. Hori left the rest behind the locked door and tried to put the past behind him. But Jan wanted people to understand what the Japanese families had been through. When she discovered the trunks, she cut a hole in the floor of the tea house and replaced it with glass, so you can see down into the basement, where everything sits frozen in time, just as it was 60 years ago.
And by having the hole in the floor, I didn't have to be here and talk about it every day. Plus, when you talk about it, somehow you project your impressions on people. So I thought if they could see it without my talking, they could feel their own impressions as to what happened here.
The project hasn't been easy for Jan. She's done all the work on her own while running a hotel, and not everyone has agreed with how she's handled the artifacts.
I was criticized in the beginning for not taking it all out of here and putting it in a basement in some museum, but what significance does it have? I mean, the trunks don't have any significance in some museum. I mean, they have more significance, I think, in where it happened and the story that's here with the building. It's like when I went to Athens and found out I had to go to London to see the Greek ruins, I thought, that just doesn't even fit for me. I mean, you go to Athens to see the Greek ruins, not London, right? So I thought that was never going to happen here.
We're standing on the sidewalk in front of the tea house after our tour. The two women from the bathhouse are thanking Eddie over and over again. They can't stop talking about how lucky they were to be there at the right time. I want to tell them that actually they aren't that lucky, that these are the types of moments that happen all the time at the Panama. But instead, I look over at Eddie, who takes a drag off his cigarette and looks up the hill at Main Street. "That used to be a dirt road," he says. Things sure have changed. In Seattle's Japantown, I'm David Weinberg for Weekend America.
David tells us that this weekend, people at the Panama Hotel are gathered around the radio in the tea house, listening to our radio story. Another chance for history, tea, and conversation at the Panama.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Don't you just hate it when someone drops a bomb at the pool? And I'm not talking about a cannonball. Coming up on Weekend America.
Thank you.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Now, most of you work Monday through Friday, and most of our show is geared toward you. The weekend is your time off. But I work weekends, and so do a lot of you, and we want to honor you, too, with a series we call Weekend Shift. On weekends in St. Paul, the diners at Cafe 128 get to feast because head chef Ian Pierce and his team are on the job. Reporter Michael May paid a visit to Chef Pierce at his office. That is the kitchen.
Saturday night, we have 60 seats in the restaurant, 40 people eating between 5 and 6 o'clock, and probably about another 100 for the rest of the night.
Chef Ian Pierce is still running around this small kitchen, finishing prep work for the coming rush.
I got toasty foos in the oven.
I've known Ian since high school. He was sort of a hippie and class clown. It's fair to say he never lived up to his potential as a student. So I was a bit surprised when I read reviews calling him one of St. Paul's best chefs. I guess we all grow up, sort of.
I wanna be your brother, brother, you, brother, boy.
You got any lemons?
Yup. The prankster spirit is still intact and still serving the same purpose it did in high school, keeping everyone in good humor in the face of adversity. Ian runs his kitchen like a pirate's galley, even down to the stupid nicknames.
Charmin Ultra, BFO, Baby F***o.
What's up?
Niblet. Just tell him to get out of the way, Funkenstein.
That'd be me, in the way. And then to top it off, there's the one-handed dishwasher, Siggy Sue.
Had this guy here for 6 years, and he's awesome. I mean, the guy's got one hand, you know, and he's better than any dishwasher I've ever seen.
Funkenstein's pulling toasty poos out of the oven. BFO's hovering over the grill. Siggy Sue is a blur of suds and hot water. The temperature in here feels like 90 degrees. Everyone's sweating, and they've got 40 entrees to get out in the next hour.
I'm gonna give you up, I'm gonna let you down.
Things begin to unravel just as they're getting into the groove. Funkenstein breaks the Cajun cream sauce. It's got to be cooked at just the right temperature or the butter separates into an oily mess. And they run out of a key ingredient, Tabasco. So they decide to try harissa, a Moroccan spice.
That's about the best we're going to do at this point.
Hey, it's the same color, right?
Ian runs over to the stove, dumps the ingredients into a saucepan, and starts whisking like a madman.
Harissa, stock, cream, shallots.
It seems like you definitely have to have a little bit of a masochistic mentality.
We like to really just get killed with tickets. We love to just have a ton of people in the restaurant and just pound it out. It's thrilling.
But this torture does have its own rewards. A recent review said that Cafe 128 should win an Oscar for good food. But Ian maintains that it's more about hard work than artistic genius.
You know, you've got to be kind of humble about it. It's not like magic. Somebody wrote an article, and they talked about how I had culinary magic, and everybody around here is just laughing. So they say it all the time. Culinary magic. Oh, yeah, he's a real wizard over there.
The brew in the boiling cauldron is giving off an intoxicating aroma of butter and spice. Just in time. There are two grilled fillets of organic salmon waiting for their Cajun complement.
This Cajun sauce, which has now become Spanish cream sauce. Here's the thing, though. Some people might think of that as blasphemy, but it's going to taste great. And that's all that matters. Carmen, hit me up with a little bit of garlic in here, please.
The salmon gets sauced and heads out onto the floor. The dinner rush is over. And everyone looks a bit dazed. Dishes and ingredients litter the kitchen.
You know, at the end of the night, man, after you've been prepping and cooking for 12 hours straight, and then you look around and the place is a mess, and you're like, oh my gosh, I gotta clean. And then you somehow get through it, you know, maybe a few beers, maybe a couple shots, whatever's hiding in Funkenstein's locker. And then you come back the next day and do it again, and it's a lot of fun.
In St. Paul, I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
This weekend, Chef Ian is making the house special, baby back ribs featuring his handmade sauce and its 40 ingredients. And if you want to see what it's like in Chef Ian's kitchen during the dinner rush at Cafe 128, we've got photos and a video. Check it all out at weekendamerica.org. Yum.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This weekend, of course, the Beijing Olympics are underway. With all the athletes running, vaulting, boxing, fencing, you may only catch a fleeting glimpse of the rowers. There are 14 rowing events. The U.S. has the highest number of Olympic rowing medalists of any country. Don Spiro is not one of them, but he came close. His daughter Laura recently went out with him to the Potomac Boat Club in Washington, D.C. to get the whole story.
Tell me what you usually do when you get here in the morning.
Put my stuff in my locker, do a certain backstretch, which I do at this age.
Can I tape your backstretch?
It makes absolutely no sound, fortunately. If it's making noise, then I'm in big trouble.
My dad is an Olympic athlete.
I don't hold it, I just do repeats.
Summer Games, Tokyo, apart. Japan.
Right knee, left knee.
1964.
Sit on a bench, right forearm on my right knee. And then, of course, I do the other side. Took a couple years of practice to get that straight.
Dad's road to the Olympics began at Cornell University, after he got cut from the tennis team. In 1962, he and some college buddies qualified a four-man boat for the World Championships in Lucerne, Switzerland.
I saw all these boats, you know. I just thought, this is unbelievable.
ABC News covered the finals of the men's single sculls, which starred the reigning Olympic champion.
Ivanov, many think, is the world's greatest sculler.
Vyacheslav Ivanov of Russia. I would grow up knowing Ivanov as a name with an imaginary face, like a character in a book.
He had angular features and these kind of hawk-like eyes. Short cropped hair, I think we all did in those days.
You had hair in those days?
I did have hair in those days, and I got pictures to prove it, my dear.
My dad watched as Ivanov sprinted from third place into first in the last 500 meters of the race. 2 years later, Dad returned to the World Championships in a single, where he faced Ivanov for the first time. A friend who'd lost to the Russian in Lucerne gave my dad some advice.
What you have to know about Ivanov is he can sprint by everybody in the world. That's how he wins his races. If you have a length on him with 500 meters to go, he'll beat you by a length. It always happens. And that's what happened. And I came back from that race saying, okay, now I know what I have to do.
Dad and Ivanov were scheduled for a showdown later that summer at the Tokyo Olympics.
And I spent
two months, he rode twice a day.
Each workout
was 500 meter pieces. The last three were a sprint, just like the last 500 of the race.
And it was brutal. It was so hard.
And every time he did it, he would think about Ivanov.
Think of Ivanov passing me.
Away from the camera is Don Spiro of the United States.
We get to Tokyo, and my heat had Ivanov and me, and the flat water was perfect conditions. 500 meters to go, I have a length and a quarter of open water. And, you know, he looks at me, and I see this gleam in his eye, like, I'm going to eat this guy for lunch.
Wait, now, did you actually see his eye?
No, but he's got very sharp
this
features.
This is legend in our family. Sometimes, I think I was there, too.
You know, my mental image was the water started to froth under his boat. You know, I know that wasn't happening, but I said, here he comes. I said, okay.
Ivanov is taking a sprint. Let's see if Spiro can match it.
And he moved, and I moved. We just kind of went together, and we came charging into that last 500, and I thought, it's just like it's supposed to be. I'm holding him. He's not going to get me.
Something happened to the Russian. He stopped.
And with about 10 strokes to go, he realized he wasn't going to pass me, and he stopped. He actually stopped rowing. It's the best race I ever rode in my life. It was the wrong time because it was the heats, not the final.
In the final, Ivanov sprinted to his third Olympic gold. My dad came in sixth. He trained for another 2 years before he finally met Ivanov again and defeated him at the 66 World Championships in Yugoslavia.
When I crossed that line, I was elated, of course. Hot damn, I'm the world champion. And then the next thing I thought about was, I don't have to row anymore. I'm not going to row anymore. I'm going to finish my thesis.
My dad went back to his doctorate in physics. He still sees many of his past opponents at friendly reunions. But Ivanov was always remote. My dad saw him only once more, at a gathering of world champions in 1989.
Ivanov never changed. He sits in his boat, shoves off, and he gets this defiant sort of snarl in his face. And I swear to God, he took a racing start off the float. boom, 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 like he was about to go out and row the finals of the Olympics. It was incredible. It was beautiful. It was perfect. He took about 15 strokes and almost had a coronary attack.
My dad will be 69 on the first day of the Beijing Olympics. He's still rowing, but when we watch the Olympics together, I know it's a different, more professionalized world than what he experienced. For my dad, the challenge of Ivanov was like a supercharged puzzle, and besting him to win a world title was the necessary final piece.
Beautiful morning, sun coming up.
That's what I did. It's not who I am.
Get yours.
I've never felt that I had to row to prove anything, because I already did that.
In Washington, D.C., I'm Laura Spiro for Weekend America.
Take a look at the Spiro family album, including a handshake with Ivanov. Those eyes! It's at weekendamerica.org.
Welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul. Bill Radke's in Los Angeles. It's August, and the best place to spend August, especially on the weekends, is the pool. But it's not always so pleasant. I remember the time when I was 11, and I really thought it was a good idea to stuff my bikini top with Kleenex to round out the look, so to speak.
At the pool. Good idea. My older brother, Andy, dove off the side into the shallow end of a pool and came up with a bloody broken nose. Ooh. Des, I am still waiting for the day I dive without that image coming to my mind. Oh. When will it leave me be?
My goodness. Well, we asked you about your most memorable moments at the pool, and some of you, like Bill just did, made us really sorry that we asked that question.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Well, here's another story. It takes place in Los Angeles at the Griffith Park Public Pool. And just a warning, the following account contains a moment that's pretty gross.
It started off as a normal day.
A cloudless, sunny day in Southern California.
Brown Tuesday. I think it was a Tuesday, but...
Thanks.
Thank you.
We showed up at the pool.
There you go.
The usual suspects.
My name is Max Biscoe, and I'm a production designer.
My name's Henry. I'm an actor.
I'm a filmmaker. My name is Bob. Can you work on it?
Bob, the honorary chairman of the country club.
We're pooletarians, the group of us.
We're all unemployed. If we weren't unemployed, we wouldn't be here. We'd all be, somewhere else working.
On the day of the incident at the Griffith Park pool, I was sitting here staring into the water, the reflections in the water, mesmerized. Sometimes we'll just
swim, lounge around,
stand in the shallow end and discuss philosophy, politics.
There's a lot of chat about get-quick-rich schemes.
Relationships.
That never come to fruition.
The nature of the infinite.
Yeah, I don't understand why they double bag at places like Trader Joe's when they should just make a stronger single bag.
The day that the incident occurred.
A day which we live in infamy.
I had been swimming in the adult swim area. I was right near the lifeguard station.
I suddenly heard the whistles go off. That caught my attention. I thought it was going to be a rescue drill.
And suddenly the lifeguard shouted,
"The pool is now closed!
Okay, everybody out. It's an emergency. The pool's closed." There was kind of mass confusion.
Like in Jaws, like when everybody's screaming and trying to get out of the water. There's the dun-dun. Dun-dum. You know, that EF. Dun-dum. How do I know that it's EF? John Williams in an interview.
A lot of people, no, why? What's, we should be able to swim. It's only, 2:30.
It was an unusual time of day for them to do that, so I was kind of puzzled. And I saw Henry asking the lifeguard something.
I overheard the lifeguard telling this woman and her child, you don't really want to know why we're closing the pool down. And she said, no, I want to know.
I saw him laughing, and then when he came over here up on the grassy knoll, he explained to me,
there's poop. Someone pooped in the pool.
And I've been going to public pools since I was a kid, and Brown Tuesday was the first day I'd actually heard of somebody clipping a yam in a pool.
This is a sacred place. This is the source. This is where we return to, and somebody, dropped a baby Ruth bar in the sacred waters.
It's probably someone very young and very small.
That's no excuse.
It happens a lot. We've had it almost four times this summer. I'm a lifeguard, Fabiola Paredes. Usually one of the guards that are walking around will spot it, or the parents spot it. We'll get our manager to come and check it out to see if it actually is poop, and then we get everybody out of the water as soon as possible.
I thought they had to drain the pool out.
No, we don't get the water out. We just, like, clean it out, vacuum pretty much, and make sure there's enough chlorine in the water to reopen to the public.
That was the thing about the whole incident that really burned me the most, was that I had been defending how clean the pool was a few days before to someone who is kind of averse to the idea of going into a public pool.
The whole deal has been slightly sullied for this summer.
What would your life be like without the pool?
Less dishes in the sink, but not as many good stories, I think.
You can check out the rest of our pool series. It's all at our website, weekinamerica.org. For most of us, there's still a lot of summer left, but if you're heading off to college, it's almost time to say goodbye to summer and hello to college life.
My college was only 25 miles away, but I remember all the freeway exits I didn't recognize. Like, I'd never heard of that one. I've never heard of that one. And they just piled up as I got farther and farther from my old bedroom.
I remember my parents dropping me off at the University of Maryland, and I was excited. I wasn't scared at all. But my mom still talks about that day where I disappeared from her sight, and she always says that I was so small and those buildings were so big.
What are your stories from the first day of school? And we're not looking just for the everything was great type of stories. We want the embarrassing and the funny and the unbelievable.
Like, were you wearing heels and you just took a tumble down the stairs and you land right at the feet of the cutest guy on campus?
You were paired with a roommate with a misleadingly gender-neutral name? I don't know.
Whatever your unbelievable first day of college stories are, we want to know about them.
Send them to us while you're spending time with us at our website, weekendamerica.org. With these food prices, it sure would be nice to live off the land. Too bad you live in a city. Wait a minute, we've got an idea next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at Calvert.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This economy is hard on us in many ways, including the high price of commodities like oil and food. Well, at least the food part is not bothering Nancy Clem as much as it is the rest of us, because she gets a great deal of her food for free by foraging. And I don't mean in the forest. Nancy has foraged her way across America and here in urban Los Angeles. She teaches weekend classes in how to find food all around you, including in the city. My producer and I met up with her near downtown Los Angeles to see what we could eat.
You guys are like radio people. You're like connected by a cord.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Bill Radke.
Hi, Bill.
We picked a busy street to forage on.
Yeah, well, we're mostly surrounded by busy streets in L.A., so why not start here?
Perfect.
We're already here. There's already something to eat right here.
And you're looking down next to the sidewalk.
Yeah, there's a couple plants here that we can taste.
To me, this is a bushy, overgrown mess. What do you see?
Food and medicine.
What are we looking at?
Pepper grass. Tastes like pepper. It has little heart-shaped leaves. It's really distinguishable from other plants. It's a really easy thing to notice in the landscape. And both the flowers and the seeds are edible. Do you want to try some, Bill?
I'd love to try some. Now, are we going to rinse this?
We're going to take our risks.
Mambo.
Oh, that's very strong. That got a real peppery blast in the flour.
We'll probably snip a few of these to use as an ingredient in our salad. We can do a little walking now.
We've moved away from the busy street a bit now.
A couple things I do try to do when I'm foraging is I will try to forage away from cars and away from dog areas.
You look like you kind of wanted to say something like dog waste, and then you didn't want to say it. How much do you think about toxins, pollution, dogs?
I think about it all the time. If I look at, you know, a lot of our choices in food are highly processed, and I feel like there's more toxins in that processing and things that are being released into our waterways, into our soils, and into our bodies than there are from picking some wild plants that are growing in city soils. So this is more about connecting to the earth and getting us outside more and enjoying things in simple ways. I actually think people are shopping so much because they don't know how to forage anymore. It's their hunting-gathering instinct kind of coming into play, and this is a great way to stop shopping. This is all over the place in the hills around Los Angeles. This is a wild mustard. This is chickweed. You've had nasturtium, I'm sure. Mallow again. Wood sorrel. Mexican tea marigold. It's really delightful. It's just wild fennel. But one thing that's really nice about this is that you can actually take time to smell the flowers as you go by them. That's just some really lovely jasmine we could go over. But I'm really aiming at this lemon tree.
Okay.
I'm gonna get one of these lemons, Bill. You're so tall, and I'm only 5'5". And
I can reach that,
oranges.
Nancy.
They're oranges. Even better. Great.
Hi. We're doing a radio story. Can I ask you a question? We're talking about the plants all around us. Do you ever forage?
Yes.
What do you eat in your yard?
Tomatoes, fruit.
Do you ever eat what you see on the street?
Of course not.
My guest does.
You ever had one of these?
No.
Here, try one.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. I eat them all the time.
You just ate wood sorrel.
It's good.
I'm finding out you'd be surprised what you could eat that's growing by the side of the road.
But you know, the point is that when you find the flowers in the street, the dogs doing peeping in the flowers.
The dogs. This is what everyone brings up, Nancy.
That's the problem.
Yeah, your dog does have access to all your plants, ma'am.
That's my dog.
It's her dog.
Yeah.
We'll keep moving.
Okay, rolling.
One.
Is that wood sorrel growing over next to us right now?
You're going to take some home with you?
I recognized it, yeah.
So I figured we could start making a salad.
We're sitting down on a nice neighbor's stair in the shade, and I can see the buildings of downtown L.A. in the near distance. So
We've got the mallow, the wood sorrel here.
Chickweed.
I can smell that fennel when you cut it.
Yeah, and then we're going to squeeze this orange on top. Okay, from the streets of L.A.
Mmm. I'm telling you, that is so flavorful.
Yeah. I'm going to take a little pinch here myself.
You want to share some with me?
Oh, I'll use my fingers.
Of course. What was I thinking? I'm handing you a fork. Mmm. Nancy Clem is a grower, forager, and artist. She teaches food courses at UCLA, but this is not a Southern California thing. She forages all over the world. In the U.S., she says some people look at her like she's nuts, but immigrants will often give her a nod and a smile because they know what she's up to. If you're interested in foraging, Nancy reminds you that not everything is edible, so do your homework and eat only what you recognize. And that's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our show is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Michael Raphael, Susie Lechtenberg, and Tim Bomba.
Also Chrissy Clark, Brendan Newnham, E. Okobi, Phyllis Owens, Christina Pena, Angela Kim, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. I hope you'll get a free podcast of it by just visiting our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. It's the weekend. Enjoy.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Picture this. It's Friday night or Saturday afternoon. You're home. No, wait. You're driving in your car. What song are you listening to?
It's really spastic, but it also has undertones of something a little bit more serious.
I'm on fire. I'm ready to bust a move. I'm Bill Radke, the host of Weekend America. Join us each week as we capture the sound of your weekend.